A figure four amongst blurry red mist and lights consolidates to form the red Film 4 logo. A shaft of light in darkness opens out into the white-on-black Film Council logo. An ice screw is twisted into a glacier. A carabiner is clipped onto a mountaineer's rope. An ice pick is thrust into the ice and a sharp spike crampon digs in for grip. Joe, a mountaineer, clings to a vertical wall of ice. Now in his mid-30s, Joe talks to camera.
We climb because it's fun. And mainly, it was fun. You know, that's all we ever did. And we were fairly anarchic and fairly irresponsible, and we didn't give a damn about anyone else or anything else, and we just wanted to climb the world, and it was fun. It was just brilliant fun. And every now and then it went wildly wrong, and then it wasn't.
Captions white on black. In 1985, two young British friends, Joe Simpson and Simon Yates, travelled to a remote corner of Peru. Ambitious mountaineers, their aim was to climb the unconquered west face of a notorious 21,000 peak, Siula Grande. Their story has become part of mountaineering legend. An aerial view flying towards a razor-edged mountain ridge partially obscured by cloud.
By the time I went to Peru, I was 25. Time was 21. But we had done a lot of climbing in the Alps.
The title, Film 4 and the Film Council present, appears white on black. Powder snow appears to blow around the letters. An aerial view of rocky peaks.
To climb mountains that have not been climbed before, or a new route of a mountain, is what my climbing life had been moving towards.
Title, white on black, also with the powdered snow effect. In association with Channel 4 and PBS, another aerial view of inhospitable mountain terrain.
A friend of ours who'd done an amazing amount of climbing in South America had seen this face in the mid-70s.
A steep-sided mountain pass.
I think he said it would be a challenging day out.
Title, white on black with powder snow effect, a Darlow Smithson production. A snow-covered peak pokes out above the clouds in dazzling sunlight.
It was the last big mountain face in this range of mountains that hadn't been climbed.
The view moves closer to the peak.
There's a great unknown there. What's so compelling is stepping into that unknown.
The mountain peak fades away to black. Fading up is a patch of clear blue sky fringed by white clouds. Reaching up to touch the clouds is a mighty snow-covered mountain. The main title appears superimposed in white and is almost invisible on the snow-covered slopes. As the background fades to black, it becomes clear, touching the void, then blows away like powder snow. In a windswept valley, a lizard sits on a rock beside a patch of ice. It scuttles off as a heavily laden mule train goes by.
It was an isolated spot, 2 days walk from a road, and the mountains all around seemed very big compared to the mountains I'd seen in the Alps.
Simon, now also in his 30s and with receding hair, talks to the camera. A tent is pitched in a desolate valley.
We eventually reached a spot on the approach to Siula Grande. You couldn't really take the donkeys any further than this point. I guess it'd be 4 or 5 miles from the bottom of the mountains.
A river runs across the rocks at the bottom of the valley. A deeper pool reflects the electric blue sky above.
We knew Siula Grande was over the back, but we didn't see it.
The vast bulk of a mountain sweeps skyward from the deep pool. Lichens cling to a rock.
We'd met this lad called Richard Hawking in Lima. He'd been travelling on his own. And I think we said, well, why don't you just join us on our trip? I think he said that he didn't know anything about mountaineering.
Richard.
I didn't really know what part of Peru I was in, or quite what I was letting myself in for.
We wanted Richard because when we were on the mountain, if he was at base camp, he could look after our kit.
I got to know Simon quite well. I don't know whether it was because of his personality or whether it was because he was more forgiving towards me, being a non-climber in that environment. But I found it very hard to get to know Joe.
I was much more ambitious about doing it than Simon was.
An expanse of blue sky.
Siula Grande meant a lot. We knew a number of expeditions had failed on it.
If no one had tried, it wouldn't be quite the same. It was the fact that people had tried and had failed. So we knew it was hard. And my feeling was, well, we'll just do it. We're better than them.
A climbing boot tramps across rocky ground. Joe and Simon, loaded up with climbing gear, walk beside a lake. They begin their ascent.
Since the 1970s, people have been trying to climb mountains in the greater ranges in what's called alpine style. And essentially, alpine style means you pack a rucksack full of all your clothing, your food and your climbing equipment, and you start off from a base camp and you try and climb the mountain you're going to climb in a single push. You don't fix a line of ropes up it beforehand. You don't have a set of camps that you stock and come up and back down from. That's the purest style, and that's the style that Joe and I had climbed Sous Le Grand.
They walk across a snow-covered slope.
It's a very committing way of climbing because you have no line of retreat.
The snowfield is vast.
If something goes wrong, it can be very, very serious. There's no rescue, there's no helicopter rescue, and there's no other people. There's no margin for error. If you get badly hurt, you'll probably die.
Simon and Joe are just little specks against the vastness of Sous Le Grand. Its slopes of sheer rock and ice tower above them.
I hadn't seen it from this angle, and it looked steep. I sort of thought, you know, Christ, it's big. It looks harder than I thought, than I expected. But I was excited.
Joe looks up at the mountain. The shaft of an ice pick is stuck into the loose snow to test its depth. Joe's crampon-clad feet trudge over the snow, and he uses two ice picks to pull himself up the slope. Seen from above, the climbers are little specks, ants on the mountainside.
Start doing it. It's brilliant. This is what we live for.
Joe arrives at a patch of bare rock sticking out of the snow. Joe stops by the rocks and pulls the rope he's trailing in, helping Simon up the slope behind him. Simon joins Joe by the rocks. They look up at the rest of the mountain towering above them. They move on, Joe leading the way, pulling himself forward with his two ice picks.
I love the actual movement of climbing. So when you're climbing well, it just feels brilliant. It's like a combination between ballet and gymnastics. It's that mixture of power and grace.
He hacks into the snow with his ice pick. Simon hacks away too.
For me, mountains are the most beautiful places in the world. When I go into these places, I feel an amazing sense of space, an amazing sense of freedom when I get away from all of the clutter that we have in our world.
They make slow progress as they have to cut every hand and foothold into the ice face with their ice axes. A distant view shows them as tiny dots negotiating an ice-filled gully on the mountainside. Simon hammers a python into a crack in the rock face, then attaches a carabiner to it. A spike on a crampon is dug into a crack in the rocks for grip.
I think we surprised ourselves at the speed. We got up the ice field, it was about 1,000 foot, and got up to a point where the ice is running through rock bands and you've got vertical cascades.
Joe's feet struggle for grip on the rock face.
We started intricately climbing through these.
Joe looks around the mountainside, his eyes protected from the bright light by sunglasses with side shields. Now leading, Simon climbs up an almost vertical rock face. He trails ropes down to Joe.
The fact that you are tied to your partner means that you've put an immense amount of trust in someone else's skill and ability. But at some point, you might be thinking, for God's sake, Simon, don't fall here. For God's sake, don't fall here.
Simon hacks a handhold into the ice with his ice axe.
The rope can be something that, rather than save your life, could kill you. If your mate falls off and all his gear rips out, you're dead. You're going to go with him.
Simon pulls himself up the ice face.
If you're going to do that sort of climbing, at some point you're going to have to rely wholly on your partner.
The point of Simon's ice axe bites into the ice. Like a human fly, one of the climbers clings to the mountainside.
I think we were very pleased at the end of that first day. We had done a lot of climbing, good climbing, and we were very confident at that point that we were We should make it.
Having spent the night in a snow hole, Joe uses a penknife to cut a lump of snow.
The altitude, you dehydrate enormously. You have to drink a lot of fluid, 4 or 5 litres a day. And the only way you can get it is by melting snow.
He puts the snow in a billy can on a gas stove.
Everything's so time-consuming. To make a single brew at that altitude takes a very long time. You're perhaps looking at an hour just to make a couple of cups. For that reason, we perhaps didn't brew up as much as we should have done. But we didn't have an awful lot of spare gas with us either.
Still in the snow hole, Simon feeds out rope to Joe, who is starting the next day's climbing up ahead, a view looking down on the craggy mountainside.
It's not a lot of risk in our lives normally now.
Simon clears away loose ice with his pick. His foot struggles for grip.
And to put an element of risk back into it takes us out of the humdrum. In that sense, it makes you feel more alive.
The weather begins to close in. Simon and Joe pull themselves up an ice face, each using 2 ice picks.
I've never been that high before, and it's very, very strenuous to climb ice like that.
As the weather worsens, the climbers just become dark shapes in a world of white.
Not only is it technically difficult and unstable and frightening, but your heart is going like nosebleeds because of the altitude.
Clinging to the ice face by just his 2 ice picks and his crampons, Joe has to take a rest. Up above, cloud drifts down the mountainside like thick smoke. The wind gets up and whips the powder snow about the rock face. The climbers cling to the mountainside as the wind swirls the loose snow around them. Simon watches as Joe ascends ahead of him. Joe struggles to find a grip with his ice pick. Failing to gain enough purchase, Joe backs away and tries another route. Simon looks up as he traverses the rock face.
It had now got very cold indeed. And we were up 20,000, 20,500 feet. It was windy. And it started snowing, and it meant that the whole face was pouring with powder snow avalanches.
The weather has closed right in, engulfing the mountainside in a whiteout. Only a few dark patches of rock stand out. Inch by inch, Joe pulls himself up with his ice picks.
The snow would actually stick on the outside of your clothing. It would then freeze on top of you, like you're wearing a suit of armour.
Looking down from above, Joe is almost invisible in the blizzard. Within a few moments, he's disappeared completely.
The last section on the face was a few hundred feet of the most nightmarish climbing. Completely unstable powder snow. No anchors at any point.
It was physically very, very tiring. Full body climbing, really.
Lips covered in frost, Simon looks back down the mountain. Joe struggles through the snow, then stops and looks up the slope before pressing on.
It took us the best part of 5 or 6 hours to climb 200 feet.
With the light failing, Simon hacks a hollow into the snow with his ice pick. He looks up the rock face towards Joe.
Carried on way after it got dark.
I was getting extremely cold because I was just sitting still while Simon was trying to climb. You know, I was getting near hypothermic. You just knew that if you just carried on, regardless, it was going to go tits up. So we dug a snow cave.
Joe puts the hood of his anorak up and settles into a depression in the snow.
In the morning, in good weather, we actually saw what we'd been trying to climb.
A view looking up the virtually sheer side of the mountain. It's covered in fresh snow, the rock face poking through here and there.
It was this Andean nightmare of flutings of the finest powder gorged out by snow falling down, meringues and mushrooms and cornices all over the place.
Snow is piled up deeply.
We'd heard about these strange powder snow conditions you get in the Andes, and we'd never seen them before. I don't know the physics that it explains why powder snow can stay on such steep slopes. In the Alps, it would just slide off if the slope was above 40 degrees.
Now leading, Simon hacks away at the snow with his ice axe.
It is some of the most precarious, unnerving and dangerous climbing I've ever done.
Joe tries to get a secure footing before moving on up the rock face. His leg sinks into a deep drift.
We were actually scared that we would get to an impasse where we couldn't climb any further up, because we knew we wouldn't be able to get back down what we'd already climbed. We were climbing ourselves into a trap.
Joe struggles over an overhang.
And not only that, we could see this 4,500-foot drop that was waiting for us.
Joe digs his hands into the snow for grip and looks back at the drop over his shoulder, an aerial view of the jagged mountain ridge.
And so it was a great relief that by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we got onto the north ridge and off the west face. And we vowed that we didn't want to go near Andy and Flutings again.
The aerial view passes over the top of the north ridge. It gives way to an almost sheer drop down to the valley floor below. Simon and Joe climb along the ridge.
We were pretty tired, really, by the time we got up onto the ridge.
I was knackered. And I remember thinking, oh, sod the summit, we've done the face, and I think I can't really be bothered to go all the way up there. And then we thought, well, hang on, though, you know, we have come all this way, we might as well stand on the top.
In bright sunlight, they make their way along the Razorback Ridge. On the summit, Simon holds his arm up victoriously. Joe follows Simon up onto the summit of Siula Grande. They look back where they've come from, then look over to the peaks of the surrounding mountains.
Hey. All the way down, isn't it?
Simon laughs. Joe pats him on the shoulder with a thickly gloved hand. Then the two climbers embrace. An aerial view of the North Ridge and the surrounding area. Snow-frosted, steep-sided cliffs lead down to the base of the mountain. At the foot of the mountain is the lake that Joe and Simon walked beside at the start of their expedition. Its sky-blue waters are at the centre of a sort of natural amphitheatre formed by the surrounding mountains. From the summit, Simon points down to the lake.
I don't particularly like summits, because 80% of accidents happen on descent.
Patchy cloud begins to gather above the north ridge.
We decided before we even climbed the face that we were going to come down the north ridge of the mountain, down to a col between the mountain Siula Grande and another mountain called Urapaha, and then we'd be able to abseil down a smaller section of the face.
Simon looks out off the ridge, breathing hard in the thin air.
Already the clouds are coming in from the east, big clouds.
The cloud begins to build as Joe and Simon set off along the north ridge. The snow is very deep, coming up to their knees, making their progress slow.
We expected this ridge to be quite straightforward, quite easy way to descend. We were hoping, you know, we'd be able to sort of walk. And it turned out to be very difficult.
It was horrendous. Vertical on the west side with the cornices overhanging the west side, and on the east side, steep flutings running down 3,000 feet below us.
A view along the thickly snow-capped ridge.
It was a shock, really, and it was quite dangerous, and it got a bit out of control, really, at that stage of things.
Joe backs down a steep, icy slope, digging his crampons in for grip. Thick clouds drift over the summit.
And within about half an hour to an hour of leaving the summit, we were lost. We were in a wire. We couldn't see anything.
The cloud oozes like a thick white liquid over the ridge. Enveloped in it, Joe is faintly visible as he struggles through the snow. Then he disappears completely.
Then we got a little break in the cloud, and I saw the ridge, so I started climbing back up to it.
Simon staggers back through the snow. As he walks away, he disappears from view altogether.
I didn't know because of the side of the ridge I was on, but it was actually an enormous cornice, an overhang of snow and ice, and I was walking up over the top of it.
Blurred images of the climber's ropes and crampons trudging through the snow. Simon's faint outline is seen walking through the blizzard. Suddenly, there's an eruption of snow and Simon falls. The rope between the two climbers goes tight and Joe is yanked off his feet. Simon tumbles through the snow.
I was left hanging, looking down, as all this snow and ice then fell away from me down the west side of Sula Grande.
Joe picks himself up in the snow.
You know, I got back up on the ridge and I shouted down to Joe that I'd found the ridge, you know. Like, I said, oh, I found the ridge, Joe.
A spear of rock pokes into the snow line.
We'd hoped to have got down that day, but by the time it got dark, we were still very high, still at 20,000 feet. And that night, as we made a brew, the gas ran out.
On day four, the wind blows powder snow about on the North Ridge. Joe's feet trudge steadily through the thick snow. He wears red gaiters over the tops of his boots to stop the snow getting in.
It was pretty obvious the following morning that we'd descended the worst part of the ridge, and I was pretty confident that we'd get back down to the base camp that day. I thought at that stage it was pretty much in the bag, I suppose, the whole climb.
Simon walks along the ridge.
I was ahead of Simon. And suddenly there was this vertical wall bisecting the ridge. I had to sort of get down on my hands and knees, hammer both my axes into the ice at the top, and then lower myself off the ice cliff.
Joe's crampons dig into the ice wall as he climbs down it.
When you hammer the axe in, you listen to the sound it makes, and you look at it.
He sinks his ice axe into the cliff.
I was hanging by both axes. I think I took the hammer out, and what I wanted to do is now place it in the vertical wall. And I swung, and the pick went in, and it just made a strange sound.
A spray of ice falls away.
And I thought, well, I'll take it out, make a good placement, because I just wanted to put bomber dead solid axe placements in all the way down. And I was about to swing at the ice again.
His ice axe comes free and he loses purchase on the ice cliff and falls. He lands heavily on his right leg and slides on down the slope at the bottom, then skids to a halt.
This pain just came flooding down my thigh and my knee was very, very, very painful.
He looks down at it.
The impact drove my lower leg straight through my knee joint. As the bone went into my femur, it split the tibial plateau straight off and carried on up.
Joe clutches at his leg in agony.
Quite wild with pain. I couldn't cope with it at first.
He lies on the mountainside, clutching desperately at the snow.
I just breathed a lot and it started to go, and I can remember looking across to the west and seeing that we were level with the summit of Rasnak. So I had a height gauge of where we were. And I just thought, you know, fuck, I can't have broken my leg. If I broke my leg, I'm dead.
A view tracing up the craggy mountainside to the whiteout at the top, somewhere in which are Joe and Simon. At the bottom of the ice cliff, Joe looks around him. The rope tying him to Simon leads away back up the ice cliff.
And then the rope went slack. I knew that meant that Simon was coming towards me.
Joe wipes his face, then uses his teeth to pull his right glove off. He feels his injured leg.
I couldn't feel any bone end or anything. I brought my hand out and there was no blood on it. And the pain had gone down a little bit. And I thought maybe I was being a bit wet, you know, and that I'd just torn a ligament or something.
He looks up and struggles up onto his feet.
I tried to stand on it.
He quickly loses his balance and falls over.
I felt all the bone go and all grating and everything, and I knew it was broken then.
He lies at the bottom of the ice cliff and looks up. Simon peers down over the edge of the cliff at him. Their eyes meet.
The look that he gave to me sticks in my mind. This look of shock and desperation and sort of terror, really. Lots of things in this single look.
Simon looks down grimly.
And he said, "Are you OK?" I think it did occur to me to say, "Yeah, I'm fine." And I said, "Oh, that's stupid." I think I said, "No, I've broken my leg."
Oh. Immediately, I mean, I just doom, really. I thought, oh, God, you know, like we're stuffed. We're going to be doing well if either of us get out of this now.
Simon's face is red and raw with the cold.
It did come into my mind. I'm just thinking, if he slips off the side of the mountain now, then I can just clear off, you know, and leave him and get myself down, and I won't have to have the all the hassle of trying to deal with him and with the situation we're in.
Simon abseils down the cliff face towards Joe.
You gave me these painkillers, which were effectively headache tablets, and he didn't really talk about anything. It was almost as if he knew what this meant. He knew that, and I knew that he was going to have to leave me. I mean, he could have said something like, "I'm just going to go and get some help," and I'd gone, "Right, yeah," because I knew there wasn't any help. It would have been an easy way for him to say it. I mean, I didn't think we really seriously thought there was any choice.
Right down the mountainside at base camp, mist swirls around their red tent. Richard sits outside it, reading a book.
I couldn't put my finger on it, really, why I thought something had happened. And I started to think, is one of them dead, or are both of them dead? Even if one of them's dead, not which one do I want to be dead, but if one comes back, who do I want it to be? It's kind of quite cold to say it, but I guess I would rather it would have been Simon.
Simon uses his ice axe to dig into the snow.
I thought, oh, well, he's not leaving.
He pounds away at the snow and ice until he's cleared out a hollow.
I calmed down a bit and, you know, managed to sort of focus myself again to think about how we were going to get, you know, or how I was going to get him down the mountain. We discussed between us what we were going to have to do.
We thought, well, we've got two ropes that are 150 feet long, and if we tied them together, we've got a 300-foot rope with a knot in the middle of it. So if I tied to one end and Simon tied to the other, in theory, he could lower me down 300 feet.
Simon ties the two lengths of rope together, then puts his mittens back on.
Couldn't really get anchors to lower him from, but it didn't matter. What I did was cut a bucket in the snow and sit in that and brace myself.
And I sort of lay down between his legs.
You're done,
OK, let's go.
And Simon started lowering me.
Joe pushes himself off down the slope and Simon plays out the rope.
I'd lower him one rope length, 150 feet, and then the knot would come up between the two ropes. Now, the knot would not go through the belay plates.
So he would stop me. I would stand on my left leg, my good leg, so that I could get the weight off the rope. It gave him enough slack to be able to unclip the rope, thread the rope back through the lowering device with a knot on the other side, clip it back to himself, and lower me the remaining 150 feet.
Simon passes the knot through the belaying plates, then continues lowering Joe down the slope at a rate of about a foot at a time.
He'd make himself reasonably secure, and I'd downclimb to join him, and we'd repeat the process again.
Simon has dug himself another bucket seat in the snow and lowers Joe down.
Simon was trying to lower me fast, and it meant that my foot kept jabbing in and bending the knee. It's excruciating, it's painful. I can remember feeling angry with him because he was hurting me, and I was thinking, you know, do it slower. And I also knew that he had to do it this fast. You know, he hadn't got a choice. And he was very grim-faced. I remember looking at him, you know, wondering if he was pissed off with the whole thing.
Joe slides down fast.
I couldn't take too much notice, unfortunately, of these cries of pain because we'd got to go down.
Standing on his good leg, Joe digs a hollow in the snow with his ice pick.
We would dig these holes from the sitting in the powder snow, and they would last about the length of time it took to lower me. In effect, they were crumbling around him. And he was lowering me on a 9mm, or 8.8mm rope, that's thick,
with hands that were frozen.
What he did was quite extraordinary. I mean, I've never heard of any single-handed mountain rescue like that.
The rope is about the thickness of a little finger. Cloud sits over Siula Grande's peak, and the sky behind it is an ominous black colour. A ferocious blizzard has blown up.
We're now lowering in a full storm. I don't know what the wind chill factor was, but it would be like minus 80 or something like that. I'd lost a pint and a half of blood into my leg. I was in shock and severely dehydrated. It was a point where we should have dug a snow cave and taken shelter, got in our sleeping bags and made a hot brew and rehydrated. We couldn't, because we'd run out of gas. And we just lost control at this point because we couldn't dig a snow cave and risk getting trapped by a storm that didn't break.
Joe's face is covered in frost as he skids backwards on down the slope. The snow piles up in the folds of Simon's clothes as he frantically plays out the rope and digs his crampons in for grip. Joe skids on and the rope slides through the belaying plates at an ever-increasing rate. Simon's expression is grim. Joe comes to a halt and he frantically begins hacking another hollow out of the snow with his ice axe. Simon begins to descend towards Joe, who sits down and gasps as he tries to cope with the pain.
It was all starting to look up in many ways at that point, as we were virtually down.
Joe starts to descend again.
And I started this lower thinking maybe, you know, after this we will have one more and we'll be on the glacier.
Joe slides down the slope.
And suddenly it all got hard under my elbows, like icy, and it got steeper. You know, so I'd gone down the slope and it suddenly gets steeper. And I just was full of alarm.
As he slides, he flails at the snow with his ice axes.
I was screaming at Simon to stop as loud as I could and he just couldn't hear me.
Joe slides backwards off the edge of a precipice and finds himself dangling upside down from the rope. He suddenly drops down lower. He flails his arms and pulls himself upright.
I did notice that more weight came onto the rope, but didn't really think a lot about this. And I just thought, well, he's going over some steeper ground.
Simon grips the rope.
And I looked down and I glimpsed that there was a big drop. Underneath me, I was horrified to discover what I'd gone over.
He hangs helplessly in mid-air.
And I could clearly see that there was a large crevasse directly under the cliff, about 80 feet below me.
He spins round as he looks down.
I was trying to get my axes to see if I could to reach this wall that was out there. I think it's almost as I started to try and do that, I started being lowered again. And I was thinking, Christ, don't do it, because I knew that there wasn't enough rope to get me to the bottom. And if I couldn't get my weight off the rope, he couldn't disconnect the rope to get it on the other side. And I knew all this, and I was screaming again not to lower me.
So I carried on lowering him until I reached the knot, then tugged at the rope, my signal to him to take the weight off the rope.
Joe looks helplessly up the rope.
And nothing happened.
Simon tugs again.
And nothing continued to happen.
Simon struggles to support Joe's weight. The screen fades to black. A blizzard tears across the mountainside and the sky grows dark. Still taking the strain, Simon turns on a torch on his climbing helmet. From a distance, it shows as a pinprick of light in the snow. Dangling over the crevasse, Joe turns the light on his helmet.
I knew that the only way out of this is if I could climb up the rope.
As he spins around on the end of the rope in the wind, Joe takes his outer and inner gloves off, exposing his bare hands to the freezing cold. He painstakingly unhooks a carabiner with a cord attached from his belt.
I had two prusik loops. Prusik loops are thin cords of rope. And if you use a special twisting knot on the rope, you can slide it up the rope and pull on it and the knot grips the rope. Clip a snap link to it and then a sling to it and you can stand up. Now, if you've got another one tied above it, you slide that one up. Stand in this loop that's now higher.
Being interviewed, he demonstrates the motion for pulling himself up. Back on the mountainside, his hands have lost virtually all mobility because of the cold, and he struggles to tie the loop to the rope.
I was trying to hold myself upright, you know, to keep the rope in place, and then trying to put this knot through itself, and it's this fiddly bloody rope. It's just hard to describe how I couldn't do it, because my fingers, I just couldn't feel the fingers at all. And I'd be like looking at it and trying to push the thing in and using it with my teeth and getting it round.
He painstakingly ties the knot with his immobile digits. Simon is still hanging onto the other end of the rope.
My hands were cold. My feet were cold. You know, I was very, very cold. And of course, you sat there and you don't warm up. was a desperate position, made worse by the fact I'd no idea, you know, what Joe was doing or what position he was in. I just couldn't figure out why it was taking him so long to get his weight off the rope. You know, there was no sensible explanation for it.
Simon looks down the mountainside. Joe finishes tying the first prussic loop.
I got one on and I clipped it to my chest because that would keep me upright, and I tried to put the other one on and I had real trouble with my hands.
His hands are so cold he has virtually only the use of his thumbs to tie the loop. Suddenly the cord falls from his hands down the crevasse.
And I dropped the bloody thing and I watched it fall.
In the interview he rubs his brow.
I knew that I was stuffed then.
He looks up the rope with an agonised expression.
I just thought, well, I can't climb the rope, you know. This idea that you can climb a rope hand over hand, you can't, you know. Especially if your hands are frozen, you just can't do it.
He dangles limply, clutching his arms around him. His hands are still exposed and his gloves hang from his wrists by cords.
There's nothing I can do, you know. And I felt completely helpless and really angry.
Unable to move his hands, he hugs his arms tightly around himself and waits. Seen from a distance, Joe and Simon's torches shine out from the mountainside. Simon clings to the other end of the rope.
There was nothing I could do. I couldn't get the weight of the rope. I was just there, and this went on for maybe an hour and a half, during which time my position became more and more desperate, really. I was struggling to maintain this seat, this sort of sugary seat that I sat in the snow was gradually sliding away from under me.
He struggles to keep his position on the slope.
So my position was, yeah, it was getting desperate, really.
He calls out. Hanging on the other end, Joe has managed to get his gloves back on.
I think psychologically I was beaten. Because there was nothing I could do. So I just hung on the rope and waited to die.
Joe's face is covered with frost.
And I think I would have died pretty soon, actually. The wind chill was very low.
He swings slowly round and round in the gale as he hangs there. Simon scrabbles with his feet to maintain his grip. Suddenly, Joe falls a bit further down the drop as Simon begins to slide down the slope.
I was literally going down the mountain in little jerky stages as this sort of soft, sugary snow collapsed away underneath me.
I was expecting him to come off, you know, and couldn't do anything about it. He was going to fall about 300 feet. 150 feet away from me, he was going to fall double that, he was going to die.
Joe stares back up the rope.
And he really didn't know whether I was 10 foot off the ground, 1 foot off the ground, but he just didn't know. But he knew, I think, pretty certainly that he was going to die.
Joe looks down at the drop. Simon struggles to hold his position.
Then I remembered that I'd got a penknife in the top of my rucksack.
Simon pulls one of his gloves off.
I took the decision pretty quickly, really. To me, it just seemed like the right thing to do under the circumstances.
Joe spins slowly round and round on the end of the rope.
Because there was no way that I couldn't maintain my position where I was. Sooner or later, I was going to be pulled from the mountain.
He lies on his back in the snow.
I took the rucksack off and then managed to unzip the top pocket with one hand and get the penknife out.
It's a Swiss Army knife. He holds the knife with shaking hands. Unaware of what's coming, Joe leans his head against the rope. Simon uses his teeth to open the main blade on the knife. He reaches down and touches the blade to the rope. With the rope held taut by Joe's weight, the knife cuts through it in an instant. Joe immediately plummets down the drop and smashes through a layer of ice over the crevasse and crashes down inside it. Up on the slope, relieved of the strain, Simon leans back against the snow and breathes heavily. A bit later, Simon crawls up the slope and hacks out a snow cave with his ice pick to spend the night in. Simon beds down in the cave, the lamp on his helmet illuminating his frozen shelter.
It was an awful night. My mind was plagued with the thoughts of what had happened to Joe. It took a long time to warm myself up. And really, I didn't properly, I guess. I had a very, very cold night.
His helmet lamp glares off the white roof of the snow cave.
The overriding memory is just feeling desperately, desperately thirsty. to the point where I felt I could smell the water in the snow around me. I felt that very strongly. It was quite a strange thing.
Simon turns his helmet lamp off and settles down for the night. Down inside the crevasse, large icicles hang from its roof and walls. A small fall of ice lands on Joe, who wakes from unconsciousness. His face is covered in frost and he gasps in pain. Below the ice ledge he's landed on is a gaping black abyss. As he struggles to sit up, he slides a little way down the ice shelf towards the abyss. He clutches at the wall of the crevasse to stop himself sliding any further.
I didn't know what had happened. What I'd landed on wasn't flat, it was sloped on each side, and I was sliding in the dark.
He peers down into the abyss and pulls his legs away from the edge of it.
I think I must have fallen about 150 feet in total. I was pretty surprised to be alive.
There's a hole in the roof of the crevasse many feet above him. Joe turns his helmet torch on and looks around. The lamplight plays across an icicle-festooned ice wall beside him. He bends and looks down into the abyss.
The head torch beam just went down and down and down, and the darkness just ate it. You know, it's just gone.
He looks back up at the ice wall.
I felt very unnerved, very, very vulnerable. If I'd landed 2 or 3 feet further to the right, I would have just gone down this huge hole.
He sets an ice screw into the wall.
I got this ice screw in pretty quickly.
He fastens a lifeline to it with a carabiner and gives it a tug to check that it's secure, then looks around at the crevasse again.
And then looked around and thinking, oh, Jesus, it's going to be nearly impossible to get out of.
He stares round at his frozen, otherworldly environment, then looks back along his rope towards the roof.
My rope was going all the way up, 80 feet, up to this small entry hole. And I thought, Simon's on the end of that.
The rope dangles from the hole in the roof.
But I felt sure he was dead. And it didn't mean anything, really. I just thought, if I pull on this rope, it'll come tight on his body, because he would have flown off the cliff onto the downside of the crevasse. And then, lying dead there, like a counterweight, the rope would have come back up and then dropped into the crevasse. So I thought, if I pull on this rope, it'll come tight in his body.
Joe begins pulling the rope in with his gloved hands.
And he just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming.
He uses an arm-over-arm action to pull it in. Eventually, the end of it flutters down from the roof. He continues pulling the rope through his hands until he gets to the end of it. He switches his helmet lamp on and looks at it.
You know, as soon as I saw it, I knew it had been cut.
He looks up from the frayed end of the rope to the hole in the roof, then back down at the rope. After a moment, he tosses it aside.
I thought, you're going to die in here.
He looks round grimly and rubs his brow.
I had a pleased feeling that it meant Simon was alive.
Simon! Simon!
Outside, the dark mass of Siula Grande rears up into the night. A full moon beams down through rapidly moving clouds.
Looking at where I was, it's an awful prospect. You know, you don't die of a broken leg.
Joe lies on his back on the ice shelf. After a moment, he reaches up and switches his helmet lamp off.
I think I did turn my head torch off to save the batteries.
He lies in the semi-darkness of the crevasse, breathing heavily. The walls of his icy prison are irregular and surreal in shape, icicles hanging from them like stalactites hanging from the roof of a cave.
It was dark, and it began to get to me.
A view from the roof of the crevasse slowly spirals down towards Joe as he lies motionless on the ice shelf.
There is something about crevasses. They have a dread feel, not the place for the living.
The white crystalline walls of the crevasse stretch irregularly away into the distance.
I could hear the ice cracking and wind noises in the ice.
He turns his torch on.
I'd turn the light on again because I didn't like it in the dark.
He shines the light over some icicles hanging from the roof, then turns it on the dark pit in front of him. The beam picks out sparkling irregularities in the wall of the abyss.
I felt very, very alone. And I was very scared.
A big block of ice is in front of him.
I was also, I was 25, you know, I was fit. I was super ambitious. And this was the first trip we'd been on. I wanted to climb the world and it just didn't seem... This hadn't been part of our game plan.
Frustrated, Joe thumps the block of ice in front of him with his fists.
It must have been quite late. I think that I pretty much was thinking that I wasn't going to get out.
Dispirited, he shakes his head.
Stupid!
He thumps the ice.
Stupid! Fuck! Fuck!
As a climber, you should always be in control. You know, you have to be in control. So doing that, you could be seen as a mark of failure. You've lost it.
Fuck! You can't! You fucking! Fucking! You fucking can't! You can't! Can't!
He rests his head against the block of ice in front of him and his shoulders heave as he sobs.
This is childish. I just cried and cried. I thought I was, I'd be tougher than that.
Long fingers of ice stretch down from a frozen overhang. A thick curtain of icicles hangs from the wall of the crevasse above the ice shelf where Joe is sitting. He's asleep, slumped forward, the hood of his blue anorak pulled up over his head. A thin coating of fresh snow covers him from head to foot. He wakes and looks up.
It was getting lighter, so it was 5 or 6.
Joe pulls himself up and peers upwards.
And I started screaming Simon's name again.
Simon!
Out on the mountainside.
I got myself up, got dressed in that inside the snow hole and packed everything away.
A colossal mass of black rock juts out of the snow-covered slopes.
There's just a horrible feeling of dread. By this stage, I strongly felt that Joe had been killed the previous day and that now I was going to die as some sort of form of, you know, retribution. But rather than just sit here, you know, feeling sorry for myself or whatever, I'll get on with it and I'll die on the way down.
Simon backs cautiously down the slope.
Very quickly, the ground dropped away steeply, so I skirted around this area of steeper ground.
Simon abseils down an ice face, which is close to a patch of exposed rock.
As I abseiled down, I could see this overhanging ice cliff, which is what I had lowered him over. So I knew that he'd have actually been hanging in space, which is the reason he couldn't get his weight off the rope.
He continues climbing down.
And as I went down lower, I could see, to my horror, at the base of this ice cliff was an absolutely enormous crevasse.
He looks into it.
About sort of 30 feet wide and just bottomless from where I was looking at it.
Grim-faced, he stares into the crevasse, lowers his head, then looks up.
Simon!
He would have been up at first light, I thought. Because I was desperately, desperately thirsty. And he would have been... And he would have wanted to get down and get water. And he would have wanted to find me.
Now, I did stop and pause, and I shouted across into the crevasse. I yelled and yelled and yelled, Joe, Joe. And I suppose, again, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, after I got off the rope, I should have gone and looked into the crevasse to see where he was, you know. But to be quite honest, the thought didn't occur to me at that time. I was just convinced he was dead.
With a resigned look, Simon turns away from the crevasse.
Simon!
I'm absolutely convinced by 10, totally convinced that I was on my own, that no one was coming to get me.
Sitting on the ice shelf, Joe stares into the distance with grim realisation.
I was brought up as a devout Catholic.
I'd long since stopped believing in God. I always wondered if things really hit the fan, whether I would, under pressure, turn around and say, you know, a few Hail Marys and say, get me out of here. It never once occurred to me. It meant that I really don't believe. And I really do think that when you die, that's it, there's no afterlife. There's nothing.
He looks into the black pit of the abyss in front of him, then looks up towards the surface.
And I was thinking, how could I climb out of here?
Using one of his ice picks like a walking stick, he manages to stand up. He looks up at the icicle-festooned crevasse in front of him, then hammers his ice axes into the wall and pulls himself up. He uses one of the axes to sweep some icicles out of his way. Then thumps the axe into the wall and, using his left leg, pushes himself forwards. He swings the axe in a bit further ahead and tries to steady himself with his broken leg. He winces in pain. He swings the axe again, then slips back to the ice shelf.
80 foot of overhanging ice. No way, I couldn't do it with a good leg.
Some long grass blows in the breeze back at the base camp. Richard.
I knew that they were both dead, but I couldn't just clear off and leave the camp. For one thing, I didn't know anything about them except for their first names, Joe and Simon. I didn't know their family names. I really knew nothing about them. And I had this bizarre idea that if they'd fallen off the mountain, they would have just landed at the bottom of it. And I thought perhaps that from the bottom of the glacier, I'd be able to see them. And set off with the aim of going as far as I could.
Simon.
I started to go down the glacier on my own. And at this stage, I was still certain that I was going to die myself. Crossing a glacier is very, very dangerous on your own because there are crevasses in the ice and the snow covers them. Fortunately, I managed to find a faint outline of our tracks from when we walked in. As it was only when I got off the glacier, I realised that I was going to get down and I was going to get out of it. You know, I was going to live.
Long dry grasses flutter in the wind. Inside the crevasse, rigid icicles dangle down from an overhang.
I can't really describe how scary the night had been.
Joe sits on the ice shelf and toys with the frayed end of the rope.
I thought it'll be like that for days.
He tugs on his lifeline to the ice screw.
You've got to make decisions. You've got to keep making decisions, even if they're wrong decisions. You know, if you don't make decisions, you're stuffed.
Joe pulls himself up to standing and picks the rope up. He stares down into the chasm in front of him, then leans forward and tosses the coil of rope down into the crevasse. It flutters downwards, the other end of it now tied to the ice screw.
Short of dying on the ledge, my only chance was to lower myself deeper into the crevasse. I didn't know what I would find down there. I was just hoping there might be some way out in the labyrinth of ice and snow.
He crawls to the edge of the ice shelf.
And I really struggled to make that decision. I was so scared of going deeper.
He backs down to the point of no return, then pauses, looking around. He bows his head and catches his breath.
The other option was just to sit there, blindly hoping that somehow it might get better, and I just knew it wasn't going to get better.
After a few moments, Joe takes the plunge and slides back over the lip of the ice shelf. The slack in the rope is taken up and it pulls at the ice screw. Joe begins lowering himself down the rope using belaying plates to control his progress. After a while, he stops and looks back up towards the ice shelf.
I didn't want to look down. I was horrified at the thought it was just empty down there.
He rests his head against his arm midway down the crevasse and catches his breath. He hovers between the two mighty sheets of ice which make up the crevasse's walls. After a few moments, Joe resumes his descent, playing the rope out with the belaying plates.
I didn't put a knot in the end of the rope. If there was nothing down there, I wouldn't be able to hold the rope, and then I would fall. It would be quick.
Fuck.
He glances down into the unknown, takes a deep breath, and then looks down again. He resumes his descent, pushing himself away from the walls of the crevasse with his good leg. He passes by a large chunk of ice wedged between the walls of the crevasse.
And you know, I thought, jeez, this is big.
He pauses for a moment, then carries on with his descent. Simon.
By this stage, I was completely physically done in, you know, staggering back down these moraines, still desperately thirsty.
He trudges wearily along.
There are all these sorts of thoughts swirling around in my mind. Guilt, worry, thinking about how on earth am I going to explain this to Joe's parents, my friends, to Richard.
A blurred image of Simon walking.
The thought did cross my mind that maybe I could think of a decent story that would make me look better.
The image comes into focus.
You know, and I did think about that for quite a while.
His lips are blistered, his face is swollen, and the right side of it is sun and windburned to a dark crimson. Richard.
Really, the only image that sticks in my mind from all the time in Peru is seeing this figure. And it was fairly close before I could see who it was.
Simon shambles towards him.
But he looked absolutely horrendous. You wouldn't recognise him.
Simon staggers over to Richard, takes his pack off and sits down.
And I said, where's Joe? And he just said, Joe's dead.
I told him the whole story as we walked back to the camp. I told him the whole story of what had happened. He wasn't in the slightest bit judgmental about me or what I'd done. He took it very well.
A few lichens cling to rock at the base camp. In the distance stands the brooding bulk of Siula Grande. Inside the crevasse, Joe continues his descent. As he fends himself off the ice, he kicks away a shower of icicles.
I must have lowered myself about 80 feet from where the ice screw was at the bridge.
Joe dangles precariously on the end of the rope and tries to steady himself.
I was now in the base of a crevasse that was shaped like a big hourglass. To the ceiling was probably about 160 feet. I think it's as big as St. Paul's Dome in scale.
He looks up, then down at the floor.
I remember looking down, and there was just solid snow. And I thought, this is the bottom of the crevasse.
He gingerly lowers himself onto the floor of the crevasse and looks around.
About 50 feet away from me, there was a slope leading up. And right at the top, there was this sun coming through this hole. And it was shining, just this big beam of sunlight coming in.
The light shines off the icy walls of the crevasse.
This was the way out I'd been looking for.
He stares up at the source of the light.
I remember thinking, oh, I can climb that slope. I bloody well will climb that slope. I'll crawl across this flat floor, and I started crawling across on my stomach.
He makes painstakingly slow progress as he has to drag his injured leg behind him. After going a very little way, he stops and listens.
Then I heard things breaking away underneath me.
He looks back.
And I realised that this wasn't a solid floor. It seemed to be hollow underneath it.
He looks around anxiously.
Well, I was absolutely horrified.
He looks down, his helmet lamp illuminating the snow in front of him.
It was suddenly as if I was on an eggshell.
He peers gingerly down at the floor.
If I break through, I'll never be able to get across to this slope. And that was my way out.
He sinks his ice axe into the slope in front of him and inches himself forward. He looks up again at the light at the end of the slope, which shines in through curtains of icicles on the walls of the crevasse.
I thought, right, I'm on it. This is solid now.
He smiles to himself, then with a resolved look, digs his ice axe in once again and pulls himself forwards.
I started to get my axe in and hop up.
He drags himself up the slope, his weather-beaten face grimacing with the effort.
It is extremely painful. As your legs hopped up, you know, they both came down together.
He digs the axe in for purchase.
I would try and get into a body position so that my left foot went in first. But I inevitably went onto my broken leg. I'd feel the displacement go, the bone move. So every hop, I'd nearly faint. It was just excruciatingly painful.
Joe digs his axes in and inches forwards. Now very close to the light, he pulls himself up the slope towards it. His broken leg drags behind him, slowing him down like a ball and chain. Despite this, he looks up and grins as he approaches the mouth of the aperture. Joe doggedly swings his ice axes and drags himself forwards with them. Finally, he emerges into the daylight. Outside, it's a glorious day, the sun shining off the white slopes of the mountain.
And it was a bright, sunny day.
Wow,
the whole world has just come back.
Fluffy white clouds scud across the sky above.
I was lying on the snow, just laughing.
He takes his climbing helmet off and rubs his head with his gloved fingers. He looks around, squinting in the bright light.
That was the relief of getting out of that place.
His face is red and raw, and his lips have been blistered by the sun and wind. He takes in the scene around him. Rocks poking out of the snow. Depressions where the roofs of crevasses have fallen in. He lies back on the snow and takes it all in. After a moment, he sits up and looks back to the hole leading into the crevasse. He sits up straight, turns and squints over towards the mountain.
And I then looked at the glacier and I thought, well, you haven't even started, mate. You know, it's miles, and on really bad ground.
A view from the mountainside shows how far it is from the glacier all the way back down to the lake which they set off from. Vast tracts of snow and ice fill the several miles he has yet to travel. Steep-sided rock faces border the glacier, affording no alternative route.
And I think I was contemplating just sitting there, because I was coming at this having done the most serious climb of my life. If you come down safe from a climb like that, you'd be exhausted for days. You just eat and drink and sleep. I'd just come out of that. I'd badly broken a leg. I was in great pain. I was highly dehydrated. I had no food. And I was looking at trying to do that. There's just no way. There's just no way you're physically going to do that. And then it occurred to me that maybe I should set definite targets. I started to look at things and think, right, if I can get to that crevasse over there in 20 minutes, that's what I'm going to do. If I got there in 18 minutes, I was, like, hysterically happy about it. And if I got in 22 or 24 minutes, I was upset almost to the point of tears, and it became obsessive.
He inches himself along backwards, pushing with his good leg.
I don't know why I did it. I think I knew the big picture of what was happening to me and what I had to do was so big I couldn't deal with it.
A view pulling away from Joe on the ice. First he becomes small, then tiny, then invisible in an ocean of frozen whiteness. Back at the base camp, Simon crawls into the tent, pulling his sleeping bag in behind him. He sifts through a selection of clothes. His face and fingers are still badly windburned. He settles back into his sleeping bag. The fly sheet of the tent flaps in the breeze. A view sweeping in over the windswept, cracked surface of the glacier. Joe pulls himself along it with his ice axes.
I stayed on Simon's tracks, and they were weaving around over humps and past obvious crevasses and stuff. I thought, well, unless I come to a hole with his body in the bottom of it, you know, these tracks will lead me through the minefield of crevasses.
He crawls on his stomach, jabbing one axe in after the other, hand over hand, pulling himself along with them. The craggy, snow-covered slopes tower up above him.
You've got these huge mountains around you. You know, big mountain walls. And they do make you feel small and vulnerable. And you wonder whether there's some sort of malign presence that's out to get you.
Seen from a distance, the glacier is a vast white mass. As the view moves in closer, Joe becomes visible as just a pinprick in the white expanse of snow and ice.
It was like somebody was just teasing an ant and putting something in its way all the time and was eventually going to stand on it.
The bleak, rocky slopes rear up around the glacier, the wind whipping powdered snow across their surface. The wind also blows the powdered snow over Joe's anorak, where it collects in the folds of the material. Joe sits sleeping with his anorak hood pulled up. Now Joe drags himself forward once again. The blizzard sweeps across the glacier, obscuring its surface. Joe pushes himself along backwards, using his good leg to propel him. His broken leg trails uselessly. As the snow sweeps relentlessly by him, Joe checks his watch. It's 9 minutes past four. He frowns and looks up before pushing himself grimly on.
I could see Simon's tracks were filling in. They were my lifeline off the glacier. And I started to get very desperate.
Grimacing from the effort, he continues propelling himself along backwards. He stops and catches his breath, then looks over his shoulder into the whiteout.
I carried on crawling in the dark, which is a stupid thing to do on the road to the glacier, but I was frightened and I was just trying to see Simon's tracks.
He pulls himself along an icy ridge on the glacier, then gives up and bows his head. The screen fades to black. Day 6. The massive bulk of Siula Grande rears up from the glacier into a clear blue sky, snow clinging to its forbidding black rocky slopes.
In the morning, it was a bright sunny day. All the tracks had gone.
A view looking over the virgin white expanse of fresh snow covering the glacier.
And I started quite early. And every now and then I had to stand up on one leg and look around to try and see the way and then sit down again and shuffle along.
The surface of the glacier is scarred with many deep crevasses. Joe crawls on his stomach along a frozen ridge between two crevasses. He stops and pulls himself up to standing, propping himself up unsteadily with his ice axe. He looks across the glacier in the direction of base camp. There's still miles of it to go.
There was one very horrendously crevassed bit right near the edge, and I get into a maze of them.
He lowers himself back down onto his stomach to continue. A distant view shows him to be in the middle of a labyrinth of crevasses. Time-lapse photography shows his agonizingly slow progress as he crawls back across the glacier, retracing his steps, trying to find a way through the crevasses.
I suddenly came to a point where I could see ice running down, and then I could see rocks.
He slides backwards down a snowy slope, then falls off the end of it onto some scree. He tumbles down the slope. At base camp...
It was probably me that brought up the subject of leaving, partly because I was worried about Simon. I just felt it was best to get as far away as possible from where it had happened.
Water washes over a rock.
I didn't want to leave immediately. You know, I felt I needed a day or two just to collect my thoughts and to regain some strength, really.
Stripped to his underpants, Simon wades into the greeny-blue waters of the mountain lake.
Spent a long time washing myself.
He splashes the water over his head and frostbitten face.
That felt sort of quite good, to wash my hair and to wash my face, to have a shave, to sort of get the remnants of the mountain out of my system, really.
He submerges himself under the water. He stays submerged, holding his breath. Joe sits in the shelter of a large rock and takes his climbing helmet off. He puts it down on the ground, wipes his eyes and looks blearily around. Seen from his point of view, the mountains are an out-of-focus blur. He shuts his eyes and grimaces, then folds his arms in front of him.
I was desperately thirsty because it doesn't matter how much snow you eat, you just can't get enough water into your system. And I saw the rocks and I knew how big these boulders would be and how far it was. And that was the first time that I really thought about whether I could get the distance.
He takes his rucksack off and opens it up. He throws out his gas stove.
I got rid of all my gear.
He chucks out a climbing harness and carabiners, then pulls out his sleeping bag. He checks in the bottom of the rucksack for anything else disposable, then stuffs his sleeping bag back in and fastens it up. He unties his bedding roll from the pack.
I knew that I couldn't crawl over these rocks. They were just too big and jumbled, and that the only way to do it was to try and hop.
He unrolls the bedding roll.
So I knew I was going to fall a lot.
He then wraps the bedding roll around his broken leg to act as a makeshift splint. He grimaces as he uses three nylon straps to fasten the roll firmly to his injured limb. Once they're pulled tight, he stands and prepares to hobble on his way. He uses an ice axe as a makeshift walking stick. Joe leans forward and tries to steady himself against a rock with his free hand. He overbalances and topples over. Wincing in pain, he pulls himself up and, after gathering his strength, tries again. He manages to make a step forward, then he overbalances.
I've fallen virtually every hop, and it's just like having your leg broken every time. And I remember looking back at where I'd come from. It was 25 yards, and it had taken ages, and the pain just to go that 25 yards.
He gets to his feet, loses his balance, and falls again. He falls on his face, then rolls over onto his back and catches his breath.
I can be insanely stubborn, and I do like to have things my way, and things were seriously not going my way over these days.
He tries to negotiate getting down a rocky slope, then hobbles his way up a scree slope.
I'd look at a rock and then I'd go, right, get there in 20 minutes. Once I decided I was going to get that distance in 20 minutes, I bloody was going to do it.
His foot lurches through a patch of snow.
And it would help me because I'd get halfway through the distance and I'd be in such pain. I just couldn't bear the thought of getting up and falling on it again. But I'd look at the target and I'd think, I've got to get there.
Exhausted, Joe lies on his side eating a lump of snow. Snow glistens in the sun.
And I'd think, I'll just lie a bit longer. And they think, no, you've got to get there. We've only got 10 minutes left. We've only got 10 minutes left. It seemed like there was a very cold
pragmatic part of me that's saying you have to do this, this and this if you're going to get there.
In black and white, ice formations sparkle. Back in colour, a woozy-looking Joe struggles forwards. He manages a lurching step on.
Come on, keep moving, keep moving.
He takes another step forward and the world seems to spin around him as he falls down a rocky slope.
Right, get up and do it again.
Pushing himself up with his ice pick, he gets to his feet. He takes another faltering step onward.
It was quite insistent and quite clear. He sort of, it was almost like a voice or a separate part of me telling me to do something.
After a fall, he rolls onto his back.
Very uncaring. No sympathy, no acknowledgement of the fact that I might be tired or hurt or anything like that. It was very, very odd.
The world swims around Joe's weather-ravaged features as he staggers on. Having fallen, he drags himself grimly onwards, then gets to his feet again.
So part of me kept saying, you know, keep moving, stop resting, keep moving. And the other part of me, my mind anyway, just was sort of like looking around and absorbing things. And as the hours went, and certainly as the day started to go, it became weirder and weirder.
The world sways drunkenly around Joe. An icy rock face seen in black and white. Joe lies on his side and munches at a handful of snow, running water. Joe lays his head down as he eats the snow. The wind whips a trail of powder snow off the summit of Siula Grande, dragging it like an icy vapour trail across the sky. A frozen scene blanches out to a white screen. The world spins around Joe. Water runs over rocks. Joe sits in the middle of a boulder field. Water splashes.
I was very, very, very thirsty, very dehydrated.
Joe pulls himself to his feet and looks around him.
And the agonising thing is all these boulders, these moraines, are on top of the glacier. And you could hear water running all the time.
He leans against the boulders and listens to the water. He looks around trying to locate where it's coming from.
I'd fall over an ox and I'd hear water and I'd start digging around searching for it.
He digs with his ice pick, then puts it aside and scrabbles with his gloved hand. He tries overturning a large boulder, then digs where it was sitting with his ice pick, but to no avail. He lowers his head into the depression he's dug and listens to the water.
Couldn't find it, couldn't get it. And it was driving me mad, you know, to be able to hear water.
He keeps digging. He digs away with a vengeance, but without success. Frustrated, he looks around. Seen from his point of view, the mountainside swims in his vision. He squints and rubs his eyes, then looks agitatedly around again. At base camp, a stream splashes over some rocks. A billy can sits on a campfire heating up. Richard.
I was worried about Simon, about his health, because his fingertips were still quite bad from frostbite. And I just felt it wasn't a place to be lingering in. We just started getting ready to leave in the morning.
The dark outline of the mountain peaks against a darkening sky.
I did eventually collapse amid the rocks, and I didn't sleep very well. My leg was very painful, it was agony. It was the first night, I think, it hadn't stormed. It didn't snow on me and didn't rain, and I could see the stars. I can remember lying on my back for what seemed endless periods of time, staring at the stars.
A sparkling star field above him.
At one point, I had this weird sensation that I'd lain there, conscious, for centuries, for lifetimes.
Becoming part of the rocks and part of where I was never going to move from.
The starfield fades to black. The next morning, day 7, yellow lichens cover a boulder. A wasp-like insect scuttles across a rock. A few moving across the rough surface of a boulder. Joe is lying a little way behind it.
The sun came up and it started to warm me. And I thought it'd be just so nice to just lie there, don't move, and then it won't hurt. And Christ, I got so, so close to doing that.
Eyes closed, Joe lies with his weather-ravaged face to the sky.
I genuinely believed that I wouldn't make the distance, and I also believed that I was going to die, and I sort of acknowledged it in a very matter-of-fact way.
A view travelling across a rugged boulder's surface.
And it seemed very rational to keep on crawling if you didn't think it was going to be of any good.
He hobbles forward once again.
I think that it was that loneliness, that sense of being abandoned. It was there all the time.
Agonisingly slowly, he crawls across a rock.
I didn't crawl because I thought I would survive. I think I wanted to be with somebody when I died.
As he makes his way down a scree slope, Joe looks smaller than the wasp-like insect as it scuttled across the boulder. At base camp, Simon and Richard set fire to Joe's clothes. They solemnly watch the clothing burn. Simon turns the clothes with his foot to make sure they burn completely. Soon all that's left is a pile of blackened remains.
It's probably just a symbolic act to say goodbye to him, really, in my own mind, you know, by doing that.
He picks up a shirt and throws it into the flames. Joe slides down a scree slope on his side. He comes to a halt and sees a trickle of water running down a large slab of rock nearby. He pulls himself over to it with his ice pick and slurps at the flow, greedily sucking the water up off the rock. He digs a little hollow in the earth to collect the muddy water. He then leans forward, sticks his head in the hollow, and slurps the water up from it.
I drank litres and litres of it. And it was just like putting fuel in. I could feel myself immediately just getting stronger.
Joe rolls onto his back and undoes his trousers. He sighs with relief as he urinates. He picks his ice axe up, gets to his feet and moves on. Joe hobbles over a ridge topped with loose rocks and lowers himself down on the other side past a large standing upright stone. He moves his broken leg around with the ice axe hooked into one of the straps holding the bedding roll onto his leg. He drinks from an icy pool and throws up. He washes his yellow-green vomit away and carries on drinking. He rolls away from the pool, screwing his eyes up against the sun, spits, then wipes his mouth with his hand. He rolls back onto his pack.
I kept wetting myself, and I can remember actually quite liking the sensation, the warmth of it.
He lies back and folds his arms around him. Later, Joe crawls along a narrow gully in the scree.
It was just a slow, steady reduction. Not just physically, I mean, physically it was very obvious, but you, everything, yourself. I felt left with nothing, really, you know. I didn't care anymore. You didn't have any dignity, you didn't care whether you were brave or weak or anything. You just became almost nothing. It was strange.
A view passing over a lined and weathered piece of rock. On the valley floor, Joe pulls himself up onto his elbows to carry on with his journey.
I was still doing these tests, 20-minute things, get here, get there. And then I saw these footprints.
They're in the sandy ground in front of him.
And I got convinced that it was Simon and Richard. They were up above me, and they were just following on. And I carried on crawling down. utterly convinced that they were wandering along behind me.
He pulls himself along the gully.
And I can remember thinking, that's really stupid. They would come and help you. And I think I persuaded myself that they were just following on because they didn't want to embarrass me because I'd peed myself and I was crying.
A view of the mountain lake.
I don't know how long it lasted, maybe about an hour.
The lake with Siula Grande behind it.
I totally believed it, and then suddenly it was like popping a bottle.
An aerial view passing over the mountain's snow-capped peak.
And I realised that they weren't there. And I felt utterly shattered.
Cloud hangs around the mountain's summit. The scene fades to black. Joe crawls down the final scree slope to the side of the lake.
It was about 4 o'clock when I reached the lake. And I knew that at the far end of it, there was a moraine dam. And from the top of that moraine dam, I would be able to look down into the valley where the base camp was. In fact, I would be able to see the tents.
It was the first time I thought it, and I thought, I'm going to make the distance. I can actually make the distance.
He checks his watch.
Almost as soon as I thought it, the next thought that popped into my head was, well, will there be anyone there? And I thought, Christ, this is the fourth day since I saw Simon. And as I worked it out, I thought, why on earth would they be there?
He crawls backwards beside the lake.
I knew it got dark at 6, and I thought, I've got to get there. And I was trying to do it as fast as possible.
He pushes himself along with his good leg. Water laps at the lakeside. Shadow creeps across the mountains.
The rest of that afternoon, I was plagued by this dreadful feeling that they would have gone.
Clouds begin to gather around the mountain.
I hadn't paid attention to what was happening with the weather. And between leaving at 4 and getting to the top of the moraine at about 6, the weather had changed. So when I looked down into the valley, it was just full of clouds.
Joe looks around in the mist.
Simon!
And I sort of listened intently, hoping to hear a whistle or an answer, a cry back or something, and I didn't hear anything at all.
He looks down tearfully and clutches at a rock on the ground.
And I spent a long time sat there crying, really, not sure what to do, and I thought about getting in my sleeping bag.
He lies back on a rock.
For some reason, it just seemed a bit of a pathetic way to end things, just in a sleeping bag.
I thought, well, might as well just keep going. You'll end it down there, somewhere.
He talks to himself.
Don't tell your wife. Huh?
I don't know entirely what happened for the rest of that night.
Yes?
I stopped looking at the watch, and everything just started to go apart.
He flounders on his back on the rock. Clouds race by in black and white. The white sun-bleached bones of a long-dead animal. Joe writhes on the rock and the world swims incoherently around him.
And I think I just got lost and I didn't know what I was doing anymore.
The ground swims out of focus in front of him.
I don't remember thinking of anyone or anybody I loved or anything like that.
He rolls about.
I did have one time when I got a song going through my head, and it was by a band called Boney M. And I don't really like Boney M's music.
He lies back against a rock, mumbling. He opens his eyes wide and tries to sit up, then falls back with a bewildered expression. As the music plays in his head, Joe thrashes about as if in the grip of a terrible nightmare.
went on and on and on for hours. I found it very upsetting because I wanted to try and get out of my head and I wanted to think of other things. I grew up thinking, you know, bloody hell, I'm going to die to Boney M.
Joe's face is contorted in an agonised grimace, his hand tense like a claw. An image of him swaying drunkenly is replaced by snow falling at night.
I remember sometimes not waking up. I think I was awake all the time, but coming to. It was like waking up and sort of finding myself sitting there. I didn't know where I was.
He's covered in snow.
It was pitch black and snowing, and I'd think I was back on the glacier, or I'd think I was in a pub car park and I'd been beaten up again. And then I'd just drift off again.
The scene fades to black. It fades up to find him still shifting uncomfortably on the cold, hard ground.
I remember smelling something. It was a really strong smell. And it acted like a smelling salt, sort of cut through all his delirium.
He rolls over onto his front.
And I remember being really confused. I couldn't understand what it meant. It took me ages to try and work out what it meant. I mean, I thought it was me. And very slowly I worked it out. I thought, I've crawled through the latrine area of our campsite. And I realised then that I was close to the tent.
He sits up and peers around him into the night.
Simon!
As I was shouting it, I thought, this is it. This is as far as this game goes. I'm not capable of going any further. I made the mistake of having a little bit of hope that they'd still be there. And when I shouted and they weren't there, I sort of knew I was dead then.
He falls back onto the ground. Snow flutters down out of the night sky. Joe lies back and shakes his head miserably.
That moment when no one answered the call.
Simon!
Anguished, he rolls his head around, a look of utter despair on his face.
It was, I lost something.
In the interview, Joe wipes his eye. In the snow, he cries.
I lost me.
The scene fades to black. Richard.
I woke up not knowing why. And was aware of this kind of strange atmosphere, could hear the wind howling outside the tent, and started hearing something.
Snow falls from the night sky.
It did slowly dawn on me that really the only thing it could be would be Joe outside shouting. But that was completely impossible because he was dead, and he'd died 3 or 4 days ago. And then heard it again, much sharper. And it really sounded like somebody shouting, Simon.
As he lies there, Joe's boot has gathered a coating of snow.
I kind of got in a panic that first it couldn't be Joe because Joe's dead. And then if he is out there, it's going to be this horrible thing. You know, it can't be a human being because no human being can possibly go through that and be outside the tent.
In the cold outside, Joe sits sobbing in the darkness.
I was just kind of laying there, not really knowing what to do. And then Simon woke up.
Simon, you know, it was quite clearly a shout of my name. I knew it was Joe, actually. I knew immediately.
I was looking around, and then I saw this thing floating.
A light comes on in the tent.
Of course, Simon exploded into action.
Simon comes out of the tent with a lamp on his head.
Suddenly, I heard voices.
Joe! Is that you?
I was holding back because I didn't really feel it was a human being out there.
Simon and Richard search around amongst the rocks.
Simon!
Simon walks up a small slope looking around, Richard following behind him, also with a light strapped to his head.
And we went back up the stream bed from where these cries had come from, of about, you know, maybe 200 or 300 yards outside the camp, and there was Joe.
Simon hurries over to Joe, who's lying on the ground.
Simon!
I couldn't completely believe it until I actually saw him. But then it was still a little difficult to believe that because of the eerie night and the fact the state he was in.
Simon!
Absolutely awful state. It was almost like he was a sort of ghost-like figure. It was like I had to sort of pinch myself almost to believe this was true, that this was really happening.
Help me.
Oh, fuck, don't. Shh. Oh, OK. Shh. Fuck.
Simon was... He was swearing a lot. Swearing a lot.
Fucking hell. Richard! Lift him! Richard, hold him, you stupid bastard! Lift him!
I remember Simon grabbing my shoulders and holding me.
Lift his legs.
I remember that. That feeling of being held.
Okay. You're safe.
Simon and Richard help Joe up and carry him between them across the rough ground towards the tent. They drag him into the tent and cover him with sleeping bags and other clothes to insulate him against the cold.
He, you know, thanked me for trying to get him down the mountain, for all that I'd done up to the point where I'd cut the rope, you know, and he said, you know, and he said to me, I'd have done the same. Those were the first words he uttered to me.
The camera mists up in the warmth of the orange interior of the tent. Simon sits by Joe's head and Richard crouches by his legs.
And I remember before we'd done anything to him, before we'd even closed the door, he said, "Where are my trousers?" We had to explain that we'd burnt his trousers, which made him quite angry. And I think that kind of brought me back into life to some extent, realising it was the same old Joe back again.
Captions white on black. Joe lost a third of his body weight during his ordeal. 2 years and six operations later, Joe climbed again. He continues to climb today. Simon returned to England to face intense criticism from many in the climbing community for cutting the rope on his partner. Joe has always staunchly defended him. No one has ever successfully repeated Joe and Simon's climb to the summit of Siula Grande. Richard and Simon walk either side of Joe mounted on a donkey. They head down the valley away from Siula Grande. The view turns away from them to the sky above them. The screen fades to black. Out of the darkness on the left, a black and white picture of Joe sitting in the entrance of a tent fades up. Beside it appears another of Simon eating something from a bowl, and beside that, one of Richard reading a book. ITFC audio description by John Walskill.